and welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. So happy to say hello to all our listeners. And you can always listen to our show every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m. right here on Progressive Radio Network. That's PRN.FM. But I think it's so wonderful that if you miss the show or if you hear something on the show you want to share with your friend or relative or loved one, you can always visit the archives on Progressive Radio Network by going to PRN.FM. You can click on archives or you can click on shows. Our show is The Natural Nurse. And you will go right to the archives where they have many shows that are there for your listening pleasure, both The Natural Nurse shows and many other shows right here at Progressive Radio Network. In addition, we're able to go on Podbean, The Natural Nurse, and you can see literally hundreds of shows. I believe we have about 175 shows there, and there's also a nice clicker that looks at who's been visiting lately, and we have well over 100,000 podcast listeners who are enjoying various shows right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So we'd also like to hear from you. What would you like to hear about? What have you learned? What do you agree with? What do you disagree with? We want to know all of that. And you can contact us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, and love to hear from you. And thank you so much for joining us today. We have a wonderful guest for you today. He is the author of A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why. And this is Dr. Mel Borins. And Dr. Borins is a family physician and associate professor at the University of Toronto, and he has been active for more than two decades in training physicians in complementary and alternative medicine, counseling and psychotherapy, stress management, and communication. In addition to his private practice, Dr. Borins has been a regular contributor to medical journals and a sought-after speaker who has appeared on television and radio across North America. He is lives in Toronto, Canada, although he's joining us today statewide from Hawaii. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Borins.
It's great to be with you, Ellen. So happy to be with you.
And I see that your book, A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, has a foreword by Bernie Siegel. He's been a guest on our show many times and a long-time spokesperson for mind-body medicine.
That's true, yes. And I've known Bernie for a very long time. We used to bring Dr. Siegel into Toronto to give a lecture and a workshop many, many years ago when his first book came out. And so we've had a long connection with Bernie over the years.
Now, you have been a physician yourself quite a number of years. When you went through your initial training, were you privy to what we call now, let's say, alternative techniques? I will tell you, I don't love the word alternative, and I'll say why. I actually believe very much that very often the least effective, I mean, the least expensive and safest therapy, you know, maybe should be the standard of practice and used first rather than be used alternatively. But we know what you mean by the word alternative medicine.
Of course, yeah. Now, when I was in medical school, you know, I knew I got a very straight. I was at the University of Toronto, and I got a very straightforward medical education. And never once, of course, did I hear much about anything other than, you know, drugs and surgery and the medical approach. So it was. It wasn't until I started traveling after my internship. My wife and I took off and traveled really around the world for about 14 months, and we had some experiences there that kind of, in a way, opened my brain, I suppose, to the possibility that there was something else that could be considered healing other than what I learned in medical school.
Do you want to share one of those things that might have been an initial eye-opener for you?
Well, one of the biggest eye-openers, we were living on a houseboat in northern India in Kashmir, and we were sharing the boat with a friend, and his name is Jack. He was 6'4", he's a dentist psychotherapist, and one morning he woke up, his back was out of position, and he was in so much pain he couldn't tolerate it. Now, me as a physician, had just gone through medical school, I really couldn't help him because I didn't have any medicine, no drugs, no physiotherapy, no pain medication, and really, you know, telling him to rest wasn't an alternative. So after a few days of this, he said, look, I'm going to get down on the floor like my chiropractor does it, and I'll show you where to push, and maybe you could put my back into position like my chiropractor does. And of course, this was frustrating for me because even though I tried to put his back into position, I couldn't. And I thought to myself, well, that's interesting. Somebody can help him, and I couldn't. So we asked the houseboat owner, what should we do? And he said, why don't you go into town and visit the local healer? And this was in Srinagar. And we took a horse and buggy ride into a town called Hazratbal. And there on the sidewalk, there was a crowd. And behind the crowd was the healer. He was about 5'2" tall. And Jack, 6'3", 6'4", we approached the healer. Jack pointed to his back and grimaced like there was something wrong. And without any language, without understanding each other at all, the healer said, you know, come forward. And Jack moved forward. The healer picked my friend up off the ground, put his knee in his back, and with one manipulation, put his back into position. And he was completely pain-free. And so for my medical mind, you know, all my training and all, you know, the work that I did in medical school, this was kind of like, wow, what's going on here? Like, I couldn't help my friend, and this man obviously knew something that I didn't and could heal this man, you know, heal my friend with one fell swoop.
So, and without years of intense study, I'm sure, as well. You probably learned through.
That's right. He had different training. Different training than I had. So that was my first inclination, really, that there was something other than what I learned in medical school that could be helpful. And when I went back to Toronto, I met, for the first time in my life, a chiropractor. And this was kind of like an amazing experience. The chiropractor, he didn't have any horns or a long tail or anything like that. And his name was Dr. Vigiani, Don Vigiani. And we started, at that time, a Toronto Holistic Health Association. And we bring in a speaker every month to talk about, you know, homeopathy and iridology and chiropractic and massage and the cranial sacral therapy and every different topic. And for me, this was, you know, opening up my mind to the fact that there was other things going on in the healing profession other than what I learned in medical school. And that really set me on a path. I then took a course in acupuncture, my first course in acupuncture, and started doing training in acupuncture, and then started being interested in other things.
So wait a minute. That's a big thing. So that's a whole huge thing, because you don't just like become an acupuncturist. You have to make, that's a pretty big commitment on your part to extend your knowledge to the whole other teaching.
That's right. It was a big commitment, and it was exciting. And you know, I integrated into my general practice. I started treating people with what I had learned, and found that, you know, I was getting some success. And as I went on and learned more, and you know, with consistent success, then it became, you know, part of my family practice to do acupuncture for certain kinds of conditions that I felt I was good enough to, you know, to help people with.
So what did you find when you studied acupuncture? Because what I think is so amazing is when you look into acupuncture and what we call traditional Chinese medicine, first of all, I'm a big stickler in terms of the use of the word traditional medicine. Because I really feel modern medicine, of course, I'm a nurse and I'm a professor in a medical school as well, and conventional medicine is life-saving and fantastic, and we certainly would not want to not have it. However, it's just not really correct to call that traditional. We can call it conventional.
I call it orthodox medicine.
That's a good word.
Or conventional Western medicine, I guess, is the other way. And you know, just to let everyone know, I'm really a very conventional medical doctor, very orthodox medical doctor. But I am open to other possibilities. And when patients come or talk about, other treatments and other approaches, at least I'm fairly knowledgeable about those things. And then, you know, some things, of course, like herbal medication and natural health products and acupuncture and mindfulness-based stress reduction other approaches, I'm fairly well versed about.
And not only that, what you said is the important thing, which I think, again, as a standard of practice, every single physician is required to be knowledgeable, because when we look at the more recent studies, we see that really a vast majority of patients, at least here in the U.S., and I imagine the same may be true in Canada, are using some kind of what you called alternative therapy. So to just poo-poo it, what happens then is then the patients will not share that. And sometimes it's dangerous when you're giving certain pharmaceuticals and then just to add in a whole bunch of herbs.
Well, that's true. That's exactly right. Many patients are using alternatives, seeing alternative practitioners, using natural health products. And I think the sad thing is, a large percentage aren't sharing that necessarily with their Western Orthodox medical practitioner.
Why do you think they're not sharing it?
Well, you know, one of the reasons is, you know, people think, well, it's natural. It doesn't really have any side effects or problems, and probably, you know, it's not really important to bring up. Another concern might be that the physician might be judgmental about what they're doing and suggest, well, you know, let's put all this in the garbage, or, you know, don't do that, or be discouraging to the patients. And some patients, you know, might fear what their physician might say. And the other thought may be that maybe they're not going to discuss it with their physician because they think that their physician won't be interested or might not know anything or be skeptical about it.
Well, I think that's a big part of it. If they know that their doctor is going to be skeptical, you know, it's just like a child not telling their parent that they did something, that the parent might say poo-poo or bad boy, you know, that could really be part of it. Well, if they had a physician like you, you may not always say, oh, sure, take all those natural things, because you, in fact, are well-trained and know, you know, the studies, for instance, the compatibility between certain herb and drug therapies and other kinds of interventions. So they can discuss it with you, you know, as a partner rather than as an adversary.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Well put. Yes, that's exactly right.
Now, you also, did you use any of these things for yourself and your family in terms of, let's say, minor colds and flus and things like that?
Well, if I get a cold, I do take vitamin C. I do take echinacea. I do some meditation and some self-healing kinds of things, exercises. And I even take sometimes a homeopathic remedy at the first sign of a cold. So that's what I do personally. Whether it's anecdotal or whether it's, you know, helpful or not, I find it's quite helpful to keep myself well. When I had a neck problem, I had a degenerative disc in my neck pressing on a nerve, and I lost power in my hand. It was quite a serious problem, and I personally went to an acupuncturist, to a cranial sacral therapist, to a chiropractor, to a massage therapist, to a physiotherapist, to different practitioners to get some help from this kind of problem. So I don't hesitate to seek alternative care and to...
And what would the conventional, like a strictly conventional protocol look like for that kind of problem?
Well, interestingly, the neurosurgeon said, look, this thing's going to get better by itself over the next 6 months. We don't need to operate. And why don't you do some physiotherapy would be the conventional approach. There was a surgeon actually down in the States who said, you got to come down here and I'm going to operate on you like tomorrow if you can get down here. I think
that's what I was looking for, because we hear that so often. And I think that in general, it might be better if we take a step back and say, especially in that, it's not a life, of course, when it's life-threatening, you absolutely want immediate medical surgery or whatever it takes. But in the case of your issue, although it was painful and worrisome, it's not life-threatening. So why don't we take a few steps back, look at the literature, see if there's perhaps an approach that would be effective. If it's not effective, we can always go back towards the surgery end.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, the surgeon in Toronto decided that that the surgery wouldn't be, you know, any better than just watch and waiting. It was his clinical judgment that I trusted. If he would have said, you know, we need to do surgery here, I would have gone along with him. On the other hand, he said, you know, this is going to take time to heal. It'll heal by itself. And whether, you know, it did heal by itself or whether it was the, you know, the acupuncture, the chiropractic, the craniosacral therapy, the massage therapy, the physiotherapy, and all the things that I did that healed it, it's hard to say because there's real no scientific proof that any of those things are good for, you know, a degenerative disc problem. But I personally felt that all those things would be helpful, so I did them. But, you know, if a trained surgeon and neurosurgeon says, hey, we have to operate here, I think I would certainly go along with his opinion. I would look, you know, at all the literature and the research and maybe get a second opinion before I jumped in. But you know, I have total respect for surgeons and their advice, and I'm fairly conventional in that respect.
Right, but luckily that first person who you did respect said, well, why don't we watch and wait? See, I would think
exactly.
With something like surgery, that the thing about surgery is it can be life-saving and it can be absolutely fantastic and the correct intervention. However, it does come along with a long list of possible adverse effects. And I think we could take, in general, even looking at your book, in terms of mainstream medicine, more of a look at risk-benefit ratio and go with the least risk first when possible. For instance, if an infant is born with a cleft lip, there's no amount of herbs that's ever going to help it. You're absolutely going to require surgery, and that could be the difference between a wonderful normal life and or not having that. So then, you know, whatever risk there is totally worth it. So I think each case needs to be viewed individually.
Yeah, you know, I think generally my experience is when surgeons say, hey, we need to operate, you know, generally it's true that, you know, I tend to, anyways, in my town in Toronto, I mean, you know, I respect the surgeon's judgment and very often, you know, will follow their, you know, their advice and have to respect that. There's a lot of things in medicine, though, that, you know, we don't have a good approach to, and that's when, you know, some people seek alternatives and, you know, we look elsewhere to find a cure, to find something that's going to help us out, and you know, so that's where it gets into the herbal, the natural health products, the acupuncture, the mindfulness-based stress reduction, and other approaches.
Now, let me ask you this. Since you are a physician in Canada, and Canada, in my opinion, and I have many Canadian friends who agree that your health system, of course, is very different than in the United States since people are not linked into paying for every health issue. And do you feel that as a government, there's perhaps more of an aspect of looking at cost effectiveness of natural interventions, or is that not part of the picture there?
It's not really part of the picture. The government pays for when you go to a doctor, a medical doctor. I think that it's a wonderful system that no one's disadvantaged because of an illness. No one has to mortgage their house because they need surgery. And I think it's, you know, from every way, it's a very good system. The government doesn't in any way pay for anything that's outside the, you know, the mainstream medical approach. If you're hospitalized,
they don't. Okay, that's interesting.
No, they don't.
So they wouldn't pay for a massage or taking herbs.
Definitely not. No, definitely not. No, they pay for hospitalization, for a visit to a medical doctor, and they don't pay for anything that's would be considered alternative or different.
Oh, they don't. Okay, that's interesting.
No, they don't.
Even if a physician, because here in the U.S., even with regular health insurance for most people, if they have a decent kind of health insurance, if their physician writes a prescription for acupuncture or massage, that will often be covered by the health insurance as long as it's done by a licensed practitioner.
No, the government isn't involved in anything like that.
Okay, that's interesting, because I think that, I mean, do you agree that it might actually save them some money if they did allow integrative therapies to be a first line of intervention in some cases?
The government isn't involved in payment of alternative medicine in any way.
Right, but you know, I guess people can choose to do that on their own, and they're spending less for their regular mainstream medicine. So perhaps that gives them a little extra money to use on things they might choose that you discuss in your book. Now you mentioned.
Well, that's true.
Right, so that makes it a little bit more accessible as well. You talk about echinacea, and you actually have in your book, the whole book is set up with many, many verified studies in terms of how you're making your decision on which things work and which things really may just be, you know, hearsay or quackery even. So when you talk about echinacea, I am always reviewing the studies as well. It seems like there's actually mixed reviews in the mainstream literature. Some studies really support that it works well and some don't. No study has come up with it being harmful to a great extent other than people having cross sensitivities to ragweed pollen and things like that, but nothing really deadly. But you even said you chose to use echinacea. Now, I find when I read the studies that don't come with a positive result, as an herbalist for 40 years now, you know, echinacea needs to be used in a pretty high dose to be effective. You can't do a study taking one 100-milligram echinacea pill twice a day, you know, and expect any kind of measurable outcome.
Right. Well, I think, you know, this is what's always very confusing. What I had tried to do in my book was to look at randomly assigned double-blind controlled trials that were done that were what but a conventional physician would acknowledge its usefulness by looking at, you know, studies that were done with a large group of people, with a controlled group that was blinded. In other words, the people who were giving the treatment and the people who were taking the treatment didn't, and the people who were assessing the success of the treatment didn't know if they were getting the placebo or, let's say in this case, the echinacea. So you're quite right, Ellen. There's a whole bunch of studies that were done on echinacea that showed that it works for the common cold, and there's a bunch of studies that were done that showed it doesn't work. And I guess where it gets into, you know, the challenge is that there's, you know, I think there's 9 species of echinacea, different kinds of echinacea. Some of the studies were done with the leaves of the echinacea plant, some were done with the whole plant, some were done with the flowers of the echinacea plant, some were done in different concentrations, as you said, and so there is varying results. I think when I look at the literature and I look at the studies and I talk to some of the researchers, I believe that, you know, a tincture of echinacea, a standardized extract given, you know, 10 to 20 drops at the first sign of a cold is the most effective approach, mainly to do with my personal experience, anecdotal experience, my patients' feedback to me, and looking at all the research. So that's what I've tried to do, is to look at the research, look at what the randomly assigned double-blind control trials show, try to interpret the trials to try to understand why is there a difference in, you know, in showing that, yeah, here's a whole bunch of research that shows that echinacea actually works, and here's a whole bunch of research that shows it doesn't work, and what do you believe? And it's sometimes not that easy to, you know, to weed out the different approaches and what's, you know, what's effective and what's not. And in an echinacea situation, there is a lot of controversy, even discussion among herbalists of how to extract it. Do we extract it with alcohol? Do we extract it with water? And there's all kinds of controversy about it. You've brought up a very good point in that even when you look at randomly assigned double blind controlled trials, sometimes there is controversy and disagreements, and what I just tried to say is to give you, you know, give your audience a little bit of understanding of how complex sometimes the research can be.
Well, thank you so much for that thoughtful evaluation, Dr. Borins. We're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and when we come back, we will be continuing our discussion with Dr. Mel Borins, MD, author of A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sacrifice, because it was used as a sweet-smelling incense and also to keep pests and venomous creatures away from the Greek home. Others believe it came from the Greek thumos, meaning courage or energy, perhaps because it has a reputation of being used by Greek warriors for courage and was bathed in and used as a beverage for invigoration. The Egyptians used an herb called thyme, which we believe is Thymus vulgaris, to mummify their dead. The principal chemical constituents of thyme are the volatile oils consisting of phenol, thymol, and carvacrol. A 1977 article in the scientific journal Chemical Abstracts revealed that thymol's antimicrobial activity is 18 times more powerful than phenol. Phenol is a major antiseptic used in commercial germicidal cleaners like Lysol. Thymol is one of the most potent antimicrobial substances known and far surpasses even the strongest antibiotics. It has been illustrated in the Journal of Chemistry and in the Merck Index of Drugs and Chemicals to destroy parasites, worms, fungi, bacteria, mosquito larvae, and many viruses.
The pharmaceutical and cosmetic industry is privy to the important medicinal effects of oil of Thymus vulgaris. It is ubiquitously found in gargles, cough drops, vapor rubs, and many mouthwashes. Oil of thyme is to be used, albeit very sparingly because of its potency, as a gargle or mouthwash for sore throats and inflamed gums. Because the volatile oil is expelled via the lungs and kidneys, naturopathic physicians use it for upper respiratory infections and urinary tract infections. If you're in the midst of a cold and are lying in bed with too much thyme on your hands, try making a thyme tea made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the Natural Medicine Chest.
Welcome back once again to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We love to hear from you. You can find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we give on-ground and online classes really every single day. For instance, later today we're doing one on a very deep study of herbal medicine, which would be looking at the chemical constituents such as glycosides and alkaloids. And you can see those presentations by going to slideshare.net and just typing in my name, Ellen Kamai, or The Natural Nurse. And then we actually give on-ground classes in how to gather your own medicine outside, that's wild medicinal plants, how to make them into your own extracts, tinctures, salves, and other products and use them for yourself, which happens to be fun and also can be very important at times. For instance, when we had the storm Sandy here in the Northeast, so many people had no electricity, no running water, no way to get food, and they called me saying, oh, I'm so happy that we did take your class. We knew which plants to use outside for food and medicine. So it can be for fun or it could be for survival. Good thing to know. And today we have as our guest Dr. Mel Borns, medical doctor, and he is the author of the book that we're reviewing today, A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, a wonderful compendium that you would be happy to have in your library because Dr. Borns uses the latest scientific research and double-blind studies to educate patients and their physicians on which alternative treatments are worth trying, which aren't, and why, and how to use the effective ones safely. It's a book that really any layperson can use, but it's also good to have and take it with you to your physician if you'd like to review a natural therapy or alternative medicine technique that you'd like to try. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Borns.
It's great to be with you.
Now
I'm
thank you. We're happy to have you as well. All the way from Hawaii today, and of course all the way from Canada is where you actually are located at the University of Toronto. Now, we did talk about one case where research can support, sometimes it supports and sometimes doesn't support, in terms of echinacea. Can you tell us a case that alternative therapy has been found to really not be effective at all and perhaps might not be the best thing to even choose in a particular situation?
Well, you know, many things that are alternative have not been researched, and so, you know, there's whole bunches of areas that, you know, there's no research to talk about. What I found interesting was saw palmetto, which is a herb that's been used for prostate problems. Initially, there was some research coming out of Europe, randomly assigned double-blind controlled trials that showed that saw palmetto was actually helpful for prostate trouble. I clinically did not notice dramatic improvement in men's urinary symptoms when they had prostate enlargement. I wasn't that convinced that it was helping that many people. There was the occasional person who said, yeah, I'm taking saw palmetto and it's really helping me, but I wasn't clinically convinced that it was that effective. And then interestingly enough, a number of other studies came out, a little better done studies, that seemed to say that, you know, saw palmetto isn't as effective as we used to believe it was. So this was some of the research. And so for it changed my practice in looking at that research, saying, you know, I don't think I'm going to waste men's time giving that herbal medicine. Sometimes there's, you know, herbal medicines that are given together, like saw palmetto plus stinging nettles and some other herbs used together. Now, those haven't been scientifically been studied, but saw palmetto was a bit of a disappointment in terms of looking at the research. Another area was that was research was chiropractic for asthma. because some chiropractors, you know, say that they can actually relieve the symptoms of asthma. And there was a number of trials done that looked at using chiropractic for the treatment of asthma and showing that there was really no statistical benefit. There didn't seem to be any benefit of chiropractic manipulation for asthma as compared to placebo. So that's kind of a couple of examples of stuff that's been, you know, proven so-called scientifically, that saying that these things aren't that helpful.
So it's actually proof. In other words, there's no proof that it would be helpful.
That's right. There's no proof that it would be helpful. And if there is some proof that it was helpful, the study that was done or the research that was done was done improperly or not properly blinded, or there was no placebo to compare it to. Because as you know, Ellen, and I think this is, you know, a thing that most people understand, is that the placebo, or giving somebody a sugar pill or doing a treatment where you're not really doing anything, for example, a sham treatment, you
don't
might
help.
Be
right.
You know, a sham treatment means you look like you're giving a manipulation, or it looks like you're doing acupuncture, but the needles aren't in the right place, or the needles aren't even inserted properly, or it's called sham. In a sense, it's a placebo. It's not the treatment. And we know that people do respond to placebo, just the power of the mind to say that something works is really powerful. So we have to develop a scientific way of assessing, is this treatment placebo effect, meaning just because the person and the therapist are so excited about it that it's having a positive impact on their symptoms, or is this thing that we're giving better than placebo? In other words, it takes into the placebo effect, but in addition, it's giving some benefit. And I think that's where the research is really important to kind of differentiate what is so-called placebo and what is so-called really something that is effective.
And, well, okay, but the thing is that, like you said, placebo itself, I think, actually should be looked at in a very positive light. And I actually believe as health providers, it would be great to support that placebo effect instead of looking at it as an interference, because many studies have shown that actually 30% of the effect, even of pharmaceutical drugs, may be really linked to that placebo effect, which is incredibly powerful.
I'm totally in agreement with you. Yeah, I think we need to look at the placebo effect as an ally and not negate it. No, I totally agree with you that in every healing situation, there is the impact of the healer, there's the impact of a person's attitude, their psychological attitude, their emotional attitude, their spiritual attitude, all this impacts on healing, and we need to certainly consider the placebo effect and how to maximize it and how to use it. And there's a lot of research looking at that sort of thing, and that's, I think, very important.
Well, you have an entire chapter in your book, A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, on laughter. So, therefore,
right.
You know, how would you measure that?
Well, you know, the research on laughter isn't, I suppose, what you would call the best, clinical trials that have been done, in the sense that when you do a clinical trial, you really like to have thousands of people involved in the trial. I outlined a lot of the research done in laughter with small trials, sometimes without a placebo effect. But some of the studies are saying, okay, there's a physiological effect of laughter. So when I start to laugh, I go, when I do that, there's changes that actually take place in my body, even though I'm laughing, so-called fake laughter. So some of the research is saying, you know, our heart rate speeds up when we laugh and then slows down after the laugh is over. Our muscles contract during the laugh, and the tension in the muscles is less after the laugh is over. There's neurotransmitters that are released from the brain, like epinephrine and noradrenaline and bradykinins and dopamine that are released. Which make us feel good, and there's changes in heart rate and lung capacity. capacity and all kind of changes are taking place in our body that's kind of the opposite of stress. So it's almost like a stress reliever when we laugh. There's research with students they measured the IgA immunoglobulin levels in their saliva, and they watched a funny video as compared to a serious war film. And they found that the IgA immunoglobulins, which is in your saliva, which is your first line of defense against viruses and germs, actually increased during the funny, when they watched the funny video. And actually, when they watched the war video, there was no increase in the IgA immunoglobulins. And there's other studies that was showing blood supply to the periphery, to your arms and legs, increase. And when we laugh and when we watch a funny video compared to when we watch something like a war film or a serious documentary. So in the chapter, it's summarizing that kind of research, which is saying, hey, you know, laughter has a positive impact on us. It makes us feel better. We know it makes us feel better, but there's actually some evidence, scientific evidence, that's saying laughter is good for us. And even though the research isn't spectacular in the sense of, you know, what every researcher would consider good properly done trials, I thought that there was enough there to put it together as a chapter, and it's a special interest of mine. I think we all know that when we laugh, we feel better.
Well, not only that, what is the downside? I mean, in any medical intervention, we always want to look at the risk-benefit ratio.
That's right. Yeah, there's no downside. No downside to laughing. You know, there's a Dr. Madan Kateria who wrote a book called Laugh for No Reason, and his philosophy was even when we laugh, when there's nothing funny, when we actually put on the laugh, that it makes us, you know, physiologically, it has an impact. And you know, he started the whole laugh yoga movement.
Right. I was just going to bring up the laugh yoga movement. I've gone to some sessions of that, and it gets infectious. But it does feel really awkward to me, at least at first, because you're actually, like you said, just doing sort of false laughter. But it becomes infectious, and it becomes real laughter.
That's right. You know, after a while, I mean, you go to one of these sessions and you laugh for half an hour, and you put it on and it does feel artificial. But what it really does is it kind of does make you much more aware of smiles and giggles and laughter. And I went to a laughter and play convention many, many years ago, and I laughed and giggled for Friday night, all day Saturday, and all day Sunday. When I came back to my office the next day, I realized I was kind of taking myself a little too seriously, and there was no real laughter going on or in the office. And even a small thing, which was I started to notice when people smiled in my office. And every time I saw someone smile, I just started smiling with them. And that small change started me to be aware of people's interest in actually relieving, you know, some of the tension by making jokes or laughing or giggling or smiling. And I found myself smiling a lot more every day in the office just by watching people's faces and noticing when they were smiling.
Well, are you familiar with the work of Dr. Patch Adams? I think they actually made that even into a movie, in fact.
That's right, yeah.
Because he did some incredible work where I think one of the funniest things, although it's a little macabre, is that when he was in a cancer unit, he came in dressed as an angel and told everybody, coming attractions,
right.
Which is a little cold, but actually they loved it, the patients. It was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And like you said, you can actually measure some physiologically positive release of hormones and other things that are measurable when people are laughing. So that's fantastic information, and I love that chapter. And you call it in your book, Laughter is the Jest Medicine.
That's right, yeah.
Very cute.
That's right.
Very cute.
Yeah.
So there's so much information. I mean, this is a very comprehensive piece, A Doctor's guide to alternative medicine. And we're going to just take a short break one more time right here, Dr. Borns, to allow for the station to tell all our listeners about the great shows that they have on here. And when we come back, we will continue and we'll talk about four tips from your book that listeners can use right away to advance their health and well-being. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we're right back right now with Dr. Mel Borns. And we're going to continue our discussion today. His wonderful book, A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why, by Dr. Mel Borns, MD. And you can find out more about his work at melborenscreative.com. That's melborenscreative.com. And if you're in the car listening to this as a podcast anytime, it's wonderful because right here on Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM, our shows are archived, and along with the archive is a description of the show, and at the end of each description, we put a contact in terms of the guest. So, Dr. Borns, why did you put your website as melborenscreative.com? What's the creative about?
Well, you know, I have a number of different interests. One of my interests is in, of course, the medical area and medical writing, but I also have a musical interest, so I'm a bit of a songwriter. I've got some funny medical songs and some other songs that I have written, and have a DVD of some inspiring, pen-inspiring songs that I've written, along with photographs that play across the screen as you put the DVD on. And so I wanted to have a website that more explored some of my total creative involvement that I'm involved with, and so it kind of gives you some of the music, some of my photographs, some of the DVD, and talks about it's got some blogs about the book and about some of the chapters in the book and all that stuff.
So all kinds of creative endeavors besides just the book.
That's right, yeah. You know, I find that the creative side of people, their artistic, their musical talents, their artistic talents, their dance and other things that they do are healing and health producing. And for me, those things are really important to balance me out and to keep me healthy. So I think the creative side is what I was focusing on, and that's why I called it Mel Borns Creative.
Okay, that's excellent. So not just the medical and not just the book, but an extensive look at what you are doing. Now, you give so much information in here, but combing through it to pull out like four gems, what would be four tips from your book that our listeners today can actually use right away to help with their own health and well-being?
Well, I think number one, this isn't really alternative, but it's in the medical profession certainly recognizes the power of exercise. And I do have a chapter on exercise for depression. And, there's some evidence that exercising, three times a week or 30 minutes a day has a tremendous impact on mood, tremendous impact on stress, and is good for, problems with diabetes, hypertension, obesity, osteoarthritis of the knee. So the whole idea of make exercise a part of your life is obviously a tip that I think we all know. The challenge is how do we integrate it and how do we make it happen in our life. Tip number two would be around vitamin D. I think, again, the medical profession is talking about vitamin D. Vitamin D deficiency is, I think, an epidemic in North America and certainly in northern climates. that when I did surveys of my patients and measured their vitamin D levels, I found that, you know, up to 60 or 70% of my patients were vitamin D deficient. So I think that if, you know, a lot of us are concerned about the sun and its impact on skin cancer, and so we avoid going out into the sun, and certainly in the winter months up north, northern part of the United States and Canada, we can be outdoors all day long from October to April, and the sun isn't at a level that would actually stimulate your body to produce vitamin D. We get vitamin D it's often added to milk, but we get it from egg yolk and liver and fish. But many, many people are deficient in vitamin D, and you might want to check with your healthcare practitioner to think about how much to take. I generally recommend people to take 1,000 international units of vitamin D3 a day. Another tip, I think, is around the whole area of probiotics. Probiotics are bacteria that are in our gut, and sometimes due to using antibiotics or other reasons, the bacterial balance in our bowel is impacted, and there's some research that's saying that when you take an antibiotic, it might be helpful to take a high-quality probiotic that you would find out from, you know, your healthcare practitioner, a probiotic that would balance out put back the healthy bacteria that sometimes the antibiotics will have an impact on. And probably my fourth tip is around mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a very popular thing these days. It's a 10-week course that was developed, and it helps with, there's some research that's saying that when you take a mindfulness-based stress reduction course, and use it and apply it and practice it, that it's helpful for anxiety and depression, for dealing with cancer, for psoriasis, for all kinds of wide variety of health problems. And I have found in my own practice when a number of patients have taken this course, it's had a very positive impact on their health and cured or really helped them with some chronic problems that improved dramatically once they started to practice meditation, yoga, body scanning, looking inside, and being much more mindful of their thoughts and their actions. So those are four quick tips that I would, say is pretty general advice. These are kind of the tips that jump out at me at this moment to recommend people to utilize.
Well, and those are pretty simple. Is there a kind of meditation that you would recommend as a good place for people to look into? Because some people think that that has too much of a religious bent for them. But I find mindfulness is not too religious for most people.
No, it's really not religious in any way at all. I think people find very many different ways to meditate, and for some people it can be a religious thing like prayer, but for other people it's just really putting your, what I find is putting your body at rest in terms of relaxing all the muscles in the body and focusing on your breathing and looking inward, and maybe even going back to a comfortable, relaxing scene from the past, and then just spending quiet time with yourself each day. Meditation is really looking inside and looking internally and spending, let's say, 20 minutes a day just really relaxing and
without the cell phone, right? Without the cell phone.
Without the cell phone, definitely. And it isn't a religious thing, and it's not, the mindfulness stress reduction program, although it talks about spirituality, certainly doesn't talk about religion in any way. And I think it's really a program that most people will find useful if they do the homework, and the homework can be,
Well, you know what? We have to actually, Dr. Mel, we have to stop here because we're at our hour, and we want to thank you so much for being our guest today and for your wonderful book, listeners. It's called A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, What Works, What Doesn't and Why, written by our guest, Dr. Mel Borenz, with a foreword by Bernie Siegel. I know you will enjoy it. It will be posted on our archive. And thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Borenz.
Thanks for having me, Ellen. I really appreciate it.
And thank you, listeners. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and along with my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, we're hoping that you stay healthy.